Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the US airstrikes targeting the Islamic State in the besieged city of Sirte in Libya, and speak with William Danvers, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress who served as a special assistant for national security affairs in the Clinton administration. He joins us to discuss whether Libya is political kryptonite in this year's election, given the prolonged Republican-manufactured hysteria over Benghazi, or whether since the Islamic State, which started out with 6,000 fighters in Libya and are now down to 1,000 holed up in Sirte, can be defeated and Libya put back together with a functioning, unified government. Then we'll examine the role of the chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, Paul Manafort, in Ukraine, where he succeeded in getting Viktor Yanukovych elected. Then after the kleptocrat was run out of town and exiled in Russia, tried to bring Yanukovych's disgraced party back to power, all the while making business deals with powerful Ukrainian and Russian oligarchs. Matthew Rajansky, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, joins us to discuss the apparent conflicts of interest that have enriched Paul Manafort and how much Trump's foreign policy positions on Russia are dictated by Manafort's business interests, which began back in the 1970s when he advised kleptocratic dictators like Mobutu in Zaire and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. Then finally, we will look into the recent spate of dramatic court rulings against Republican efforts to suppress the votes of minorities and likely Democratic voters in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Texas, and Kansas. Award-winning investigative reporter Andrew Gumbel, author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Voting Rights Rulings Could Deal a Blow to Republicans in 2016 Elections, and how, since the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court, efforts to suppress the votes of minorities continue at the state and county levels in many states across the South. And joining us now is William Danvers, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who has worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and various international organizations. He served as Deputy Secretary General of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OEDC, and also served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and as Senior Director for Legislative Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Danvers.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks very much for having me.
And the U.S. is involved in, has launched airstrikes against the Islamic State in Libya, in the town of, of Sirte, which was the home of the former dictator, Muammar Gaddafi. And the press reports indicate that although they've been besieged now for some time by ground forces surrounding them, this is the first use of air power. But reports indicate that the Islamic State had about 6,000 fighters in Libya, and now they're down to 1,000. Would that mean that the 5,000 have been killed, or have they slipped away?
Well, it probably means both. I don't think it necessarily means they've been killed. This is actually the third sort of set of strikes that the U.S. has undertaken in Libya since last November, although this most recent occurrence is very different, in both in terms of focus and operation. I suspect that many of the fighters have left because they've been attacked actually by militias loyal to the GNA, the internationally recognized government of Libya, and they've had some success. These militias loyal to the GNA, and I think that's probably part of the reason the numbers have diminished. I think the U.S. air attacks can only help lessen the presence of the Islamic State in Libya as well.
Well, of course, we remember the extraordinarily grim footage from the beaches of Sirte, where the Islamic State systematically slaughtered, I think, 20 to 30 Coptic Christian laborers. They put them in orange jumpsuits,
right,
and said something about the blood flowing into Europe. So we know how hideous they are. But what's your sense of the disarray that's always been there in Libya since the original intervention, they got rid of Gaddafi?
Well, I mean, Libya's gone through various stages. I think right after the fall of Gaddafi, they had elections and they had a government. Then the government split, and they had two separate governments. And then last December, I believe, there was an agreement signed by the various parties to get behind one government, the GNA, which eventually set up shop in Tripoli. And this is the one that's internationally recognized. There's still some back and forth with the HOR, which is in Tobruk, and other elements, which GNC, which are in Tripoli. But more or less, I think this is a good sign that the GNA is sort of taking charge, at least this part of trying to govern Libya, the security piece, because this is obviously a very important element. There's lots of work to be done, but in the sense, this is a very positive sign that the GNA has its act together sufficiently to be able to, one, to take on the Islamic State itself, insert on the ground, and then to reach out to allies like the United States to be helpful in the air with an air operation.
And do you know where these airstrikes came from? Because I recall some time back when the U.S. sent aircraft to strike Libya, they had to fly all the way from London. They weren't given overfly rights across Spain, so they had to be refueled a whole number of times.
But that doesn't surprise me that I don't. I don't know that the Pentagon has released that sort of thing yet, but I don't know exactly. But it sounds like this operation is working pretty efficiently, so that I would assume that means that it was not that they didn't come all the way from London. I couldn't say that definitively. It may have come from carriers in the Mediterranean, could have come from Italy as well, which is pretty close.
Sure. So what then is the situation with there's a breakaway faction led by a general in, I think it's in Benghazi.
General Haftar in Tobruk, Tobruk in eastern Libya.
Right. And I understand a lot of these squabbles have been about oil terminals. So at this point, do we know who is in control of the oil terminals and therefore, by extension, in control of the revenues that they might generate?
I will disagree slightly. I mean, I think controlling the oil is in the hydrocarbon sector of the Libyan economy, which in effect is the Libyan economy, is obviously essential to anyone who wants to run Libya. I think that right now it has as much to do with what kind of role General Haftar would play or could play in a future Libyan government. Right now, that future Libyan government is the GNA, and that's the government that the United States and the international community is dealing with. Their problems remain in terms of trying to sort of settle the differences and settle the scores between the various parties. But the GNA right now, I think, offers the best opportunity for having a government that can begin the process of rebuilding Libya. Part of that will be control of the oil, but I think what the United States is certainly pushing is for the GNA to have control over the oil, the central bank, and the Libyan Investment Authority, which are kind of the three main foundations of any rebuilding of Libya.
And again, I'm speaking with William Danvers, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who has worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and various international organizations. He served as Deputy Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, and also served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and as a Senior Director for Legislative Affairs at the National Security Council. So what's your sense then of where this situation will be as this political year heats up? We know that the Republicans have made an obsession about Benghazi, and I think everybody sort of probably has a certain amount of fatigue about Benghazi, although that doesn't mean they're not going to beat a dead horse. But in general, is Libya kind of political kryptonite?
No, I don't think Libya is political kryptonite at all. I think Libya is different than Syria. I think in some ways we have more of an opportunity to be able to help the Libyan people rebuild their country. I think the GNA offers the best hope there. Don't forget also that Libya was a fairly wealthy country not too long ago, when the price of oil was high and when they were able to pump out about 1.4 million barrels a day. Now that's gone down to around 400,000 barrels a day. But if the price of oil goes up, and I guess there's a reasonable expectation that will be the case, and if most Libyans can get behind, hopefully all Libyans can get behind the GNA, then they can begin the process of rebuilding. These airstrikes are very important for getting rid of the Islamic State. And the Islamic State is obviously something that has to be dealt with in the context of Libya. But it can't simply be about dealing with the terrorist threat, although that's an integral part of it. Libya also has a real problem with criminal gangs that do all sorts of smuggling, including trying to smuggle refugees into Europe. But they've also got to rebuild their economy. In fact, I just did a paper for the Center for American Progress that talks about the day after sort of issues that Libya needs to be confronted with. And I think if you begin to look at those kinds of issues of how we help the Libyans rebuild, both in terms of economics and governance, then they may be more interested in getting behind a new government. And getting behind a new government is absolutely essential for Libya to begin to be not a failed state, because it's not. Some might say that it is, but certainly a failing state, to move from that category into a state that's in the process of rebuilding itself.
So why did the Islamic State sort of coalesce around Sirte, which is the hometown of the former dictator Gaddafi? Because I've often heard of this so-called flypaper strategy, where the idea is you try and corral the bad guys into one place, and like sticking like flypaper, and that's when you bomb them. Well, it seems like they've almost obliged here.
Well, I mean, I think you go where you think you can build a foundation. Sirte is certainly a city where they could build a base of operation. It's in the oil crescent, and while they haven't, and I think some have said that they had, but they haven't been able to make money off of oil revenue in Libya. But what they have tried to do is destroy some of the infrastructure, so that would undermine any effort to rebuild a legitimate Libyan government. And so I think that they were able. Sirte was a good base of operation, and there was also a great disaffected population in Sirte, those who had been loyal to Gaddafi, and then Ansar al-Sharia. Some which is al-Qaeda linked, but some of the Ansar al-Sharia people loyal to Ansar al-Sharia decided that they wanted to go with the Islamic State, because at one point they were thought to be the winners in this battle between al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And I think those are probably some of the reasons why they decided to go to Sirte. And it's obviously on the Mediterranean Sea, and it means it's a little easier to access.
But in terms of just back to the Benghazi and the and the Tobruk faction under the General Haftar, I believe that the French sent in some special forces into that area last month, and some of their soldiers were killed in Benghazi. So what is the general's outlook? I mean, is he anti-Western? Why would he? What were these special forces trying to do? If he's, in other words, it gets down to it, is he a part of the problem or a part of the solution?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to in Libya. I spent a fair amount of time talking to people who work on Libya and who are Libyans trying to actively rebuild the government. I think that he is anti-terrorist. He's anti-jihadist. I think that's certainly part of what General Haftar is trying to do. I think also that he believed that the government, the GNC in Tripoli, when the two of them split, was a government that he felt he couldn't deal with, and you'd have to ask him why. I assume it's because he found them to be Islamists, and they were certainly more in that direction than the people in Tobruk. I think what the international community has tried to do is find a path down the middle with the GNA. In terms of what the French were doing there, I would guess, and I don't know for sure, first of all, I think it was a tragedy, and our sympathy goes out to the French. But I think what they were probably trying to do was figure out a path forward as to how we get rid of the Islamic State. I would guess that that's what they were trying to do. They may have also been in there trying to figure out ways to protect the oil fields so that the infrastructure wouldn't be ruined. The French, obviously, these are special operators, and I don't think that they revealed too much about what they were doing. But something very interesting happened between that unfortunate event and what's occurring today. There were protests after the French government said, yes, we did have special operators in there. There were protests by the GNA government. They said, you know, this isn't right. We want you to respect our sovereignty. However, today, recently, the GNA has asked the U.S. government to come in and help with the situation in the fight against the Islamic State. I think that's significant that they were able and willing to do that. I think that's very significant.
But just in the last couple of minutes, William Danvers, let me turn to the broader critiques that are going on. And curiously enough, they're on both the right and the left, with Donald Trump on the right and a lot of...
I'm not sure where Donald Trump is.
well, let's assume since he's running...
In the ether, maybe.
Yes, and since he's running as a Republican, we'll give him the benefit of the
doubt. Fair enough.
And then on the left, you have this same criticism, which is that we knock off all of these secular leaders like Saddam Hussein, Assad, not that he's finished, and Gaddafi, and you end up with chaos. And there is this kind of revisionism going on that basically, as bad as some of these people are, what follows them is worse.
No, I don't. I would disagree strongly with that. I mean, I think the U.S., this is a very difficult transition. That's for sure. I think it's a very difficult transition throughout the Middle East. And I think we have to figure out a path forward. By that, I mean a path forward for us would be, how can we be helpful? How can we be helpful to the people in the Middle East and the governments in the Middle East? And there is no, you're going to have ruts and a rocky road along the way. I think that goes almost without saying. But it doesn't mean that we should say, oh gosh, our democratic values, we no longer adhere to them. We don't think that's the way forward. I think that would be a big mistake, because I think overall we've done pretty well. And when you look in other regions of the world, if you look at East Asia, if you look at Latin America, actually those values have held out, and market-based economies have done pretty well for the people down there. I don't know exactly what the path forward will be for the people in the Middle East, but I don't think that it's to turn back to people like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi. I really, really don't. Part of what happened in Libya was that Gaddafi was such a malevolent ruler. He really oppressed his people that when he fell, there was really no government left. It actually reminded me of what was left of Haiti after the Duvaliers were gone. There really was no government left. So we can't expect the Libyan people to say, okay, great, now we're Democrats and everything's going to be okay. There has to be a transition, and the transition has to be about security, but it also has to be about governance, and that has to tie into an economy that people can believe in. This is as much about building trust in government, and I think you need institutions that are responsive in order to be able to do that as anything else. I believe in American values, and I believe in the American way, and I really think that we will prevail, but we need to be patient. We need to realize there's going to be a lot of problems along the way.
But that...
You can call me Pollyanna if you want.
Well, let me see whether your Pollyannaism will extend to Syria, because that's clearly, there's a relationship there, not the least of which was that the uprising against the Assads was in many ways stimulated, if not precipitated, by the fall of Gaddafi, and that emboldened the people to rise up. And of course, as you know...
But they were going to do that with or without... You know, the United States. That was
right.
Internal. I don't
understand
think...
that. But let's yeah. face it. You were saying earlier that the difference between Libya and Syria is pretty profound. That Libya is something that can be fixed. I take it that at this point the U.S. and Russia have been working together, but now they're starting to fray over Russia's actions around the besieged city of Aleppo, where there was an offer to let people out, but they had to come out and literally, fall into the arms of the Syrian army. And not too many people took up that offer. And now you have the possibility of a massive humanitarian tragedy, which, is, after all, was the reason why the U.S. and the U.N. got involved in Libya, was the portent of Gaddafi slaughtering the civilians of Benghazi. this seems to be repeating itself, doesn't it, in Aleppo?
No, I think it's a very different situation. I think what happened in Syria, Syria is got a lot of different ethnic groups. It was actually ruled by the Ba'athists, who in effect were a minority, not a majority. I think if you wanted to make a comparison, and even this isn't an exact comparison, you could probably make it to a comparison with Iraq. In terms of dealing with the Russians, well, I mean, when you deal with the Russians, you're dealing with the Russians. They have their own interests, and those interests don't always align with the interests of the U.S. and its allies. You know, hope against hope that sometimes they can and we can help people, but I would never sort of bet my bottom dollar on a relationship with the Russians that they would say, oh, gosh, this is the right thing to do, even if it's counter to what we perceive as being our interests. I don't think that will be the case. I think you know, Syria is it in a very, very difficult situation. I don't know exactly what will happen, whether you will have a Syria that even resembles anything that we've known for the last, you know, half century or not. I don't know what it will look like. But again, I don't think we can allow it to continue along these lines, and we have to figure out a path forward. And that may be doing some things that make us feel uncomfortable.
Well, William Danvers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thank you so much for having me, and I hope we can do it again.
Definitely. And again, I've been speaking with William Danvers, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who has worked on national security issues for 34 years in the executive branch, Congress, and various international organizations. He served as Deputy Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, and also served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and as Senior Director for Legislative Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Paul Manafort's lucrative conflicts of interest in Ukraine.
Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Rajansky, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian regions. Previously, he was the deputy director of the Russian and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rajansky.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be with you.
And Matthew, what do you make of this long profile the New York Times has done about Paul Manafort, who is the chairman of the Donald Trump presidential campaign, about his previous dealings with Ukraine, which were pretty extensive? He actually got a leader elected there, and he has extensive business dealings with prominent Ukrainian and Russian tycoons. And on Sunday, Donald Trump basically, I don't know where this came from or what prompted it, but he basically said that Putin was justified for the annexation of Crimea. Trump said that the majority of the people in the region wanted to be part of Russia. And, of course, this has been echoed and played a lot on Russian television, Trump's remarks. I'm not sure the Tatars particularly would agree with that. But in general, do you think that these ideas of saying nice things about Russia, are they Trump's or are they Manafort's, or are they both a combination? What's your sense of the agenda here?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what's going on either inside the campaign or certainly inside any of the candidates' own thoughts. But there is a surprisingly consistent theme in what has been coming out of the Trump camp on Russia, Ukraine, NATO, issues that would be of concern, for instance, to Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. And I think that has been the main reason for the kind of really rife speculation that we're seeing in the press and certainly coming out of the Democratic camp that, you know, somehow there is a Putin-Trump linkage or that there is a Russia-Trump campaign connection. I think where that argument can take you a certain distance, but not very far. And the reason is, you know what, a guy like Manafort, frankly, is at the top of his game. But it's a game that a lot of people in Washington play. And to imagine that Russian money or Ukrainian money, oligarch money, somehow is limited in its penetration of Western political influence peddling circles, that's just naive. It's everywhere. I mean, I have seen all manner of very reputable, by Washington standards, and I say that with a bit of a smirk, you know, influence peddler, lobbyist, beltway bandit types come through this town toting, you know, clients from the former Soviet bloc who would, by any light of day media or political measure, be considered dirty. And that is simply the reality of the Washington that we live in, and it is a very problematic reality. It is something that, ironically, the Kremlin benefits from, I think, when their argument is that all politics is dirty, and all politics is, you know, the elite dominating and stealing from the people, that actually the messages that are coming out in our campaign now, which are based on fact, right, which are based on, unfortunately, real corrupt dealings or at least embarrassing dealings that are now being revealed, that is very, very favorable to the Kremlin narrative that, hey, America, get off your high horse. Your politics isn't any different from ours. Stop trying to dictate outcomes and say who is a true Democrat and who is not in other parts of the world.
But in terms of what Manafort does, he makes business deals. At the same time, he also takes on political clients and gets them elected, which is the case here in Ukraine with the Yanukovych, who was run out of the country by a people's revolution. So it's not difficult to see a kind of, well, can one be naive enough to say there's a conflict of interest there, or is this something that just goes on where you can work for a client who then gets elected as a head of state and suddenly he owes you a whole bunch of favors, which are usually dispensed via his rich friends?
You know, Ian, again, the problem, I can completely understand how listeners who are trying to hear everything through a kind of political filter might imagine that what I'm saying here is just defending, frankly, one side or the other. But I'm going to have to say it again. Both things that you said are true. It is true that there is a conflict of interest between, you know, peddling political influence, which in the case of foreign influence here in the United States, you have to register as a lobbyist for a foreign power, and also investing, you know, in business deals relating to that government. But it happens all the time. It is constantly happening in American politics and government, and that's the problem that we have, is that we have actual serious problems with the institutions of our democracy that we have for a very long time not dealt with. The picture is not rosy, and I'm reminded here of a wonderful line, a tragic line actually, from a KGB defector in 1979. Who came to the United States and said to his American government captors/hosts, look to your weakest points and your biggest problems, and there will be the KGB. And that's what's happening now, right? We have a Russian state which is run by veterans of the Russian intelligence services, the Soviet and Russian intelligence services, and they are taking that exact approach. They are looking for the areas where our system is most hypocritical, is least popular, is most dysfunctional, is most dishonest, and they are doing everything they can do through illegal and gray and overt means. So all types of means, like Russia Today, RT, their propaganda broadcast completely overt and completely, you know, legitimate in the sense that they are entitled to have their broadcaster, just like we are with Voice of America and so on. But then you have, you know, illicit hacking, and then you even probably have, I don't have, you know, direct evidence of it, but we know that there have been spy games and that there are spies constantly being, you know, ejected by one side or the other. So, and all of these things are aimed at doing the same thing, which is, in the case of Russia, taking America down a few pegs and convincing the American people, and thus weakening our resolve, that there really is there's no beef with Russia. Because their corrupt, you know, rights-abusing authoritarian system is really not all that different from ours, and by all means, we should be staying out of places like Ukraine or Georgia or the Baltic states. Why on earth would we be over there meddling and bringing our imperfect system to them? And it's unfortunately a persuasive argument to a lot of people, and that is very tough for the next administration, whoever it is, because it's going to make an intellectually coherent policy towards the former Soviet space in Eastern Europe very, very hard to maintain.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rudzinski, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian regions. So when Donald Trump in an ABC interview on the weekend said that Putin was not going to invade Ukraine, quoting Trump, "He's not going into Ukraine." Okay, just so you understand, he's not going into Ukraine, all right? You can mark it down, and you can put it down. You can take it anywhere you want. So where does he get that kind of sense of certainty, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this has been Trump's stock in trade on almost any issue is, you know, the surprising and maybe troubling thing, that he has no lack of rock-solid certitude that he is the only one who can change outcomes. And, you know, maybe he's right. I don't know. But he is certainly not right that Vladimir Putin can be prevented from going into Ukraine. I understand from his later clarifications, Trump was attempting to say, under my administration, Putin would not dare go into Ukraine. Well, the problem is, logically, Putin is already there. So, you know, Russian forces are in eastern Ukraine. Russia is occupying Ukrainian Crimea. So, you know, that's not something that the Russians are going to undo and turn tail and run, I think, before January of 2017. So the reality, if Trump were elected president, the reality he will come into will be having to deal with a major European power that has seized the territory and destabilized the society of another European power by force. And it's almost inconceivable to me. I do not think that any American president, whoever they are, wherever they come from, and whatever they promised during the campaign, I don't think any American president is going to be able to simply accept that situation and say, no, that's fine. You know, why don't we just accept that might makes right in Europe? I mean, that is really... that flies in the face of what American security policy towards Europe has been for more than half a century. It's possible that that will, in fact, be Donald Trump's position, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Well, already, though, the Republican platform was altered, and what was removed from it was any mention of military aid to Ukraine. And that's been widely interpreted as yet another gesture of Trump's towards Putin in this so-called bromance, which I think has been rather exaggerated, but nevertheless, that's the impression. I can understand why Hillary Clinton would want to push that narrative that Trump and Putin are conniving, and that, of course, would somewhat reverse the old Cold War idea that the Democrats are the party that was soft on communism. The tables seem to be turning, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would point out, number one, that throughout the Cold War, there was bipartisan consensus on dealing with the Soviet Union. There was more, I mean, you know this history as well as I, there was more internal disagreement about, you know, how we deal with the problems of ideological dissent in America. But when it came to, you know, the old saw that partisan politics stops at the water's edge, dealing with a Soviet threat, you know, there were tough Democratic administrations, hawkish cold warriors from the Democratic side, Scoop Jackson obviously being a famous example, and then Republicans, of course, as well. And then ironically, during the Cold War, when asked, Soviet leaders would always say that they preferred to do deals with Republicans, this being on the theory of kind of, you know, Republicans are stronger and more pragmatic, and, you know, it's kind of we see each other for what we are, we're enemies, but we can, you know, sort of agree in this gentlemanly fashion to you know, respect each other's boundaries and so on. And many senior Russians to this day have that view, rightly or wrongly. I don't think that there is any meaningful partisan difference on this issue even today. If you look at the Congress almost uniformly strongly supports Ukraine, strongly dislikes Putin, strongly supports sanctions against Russia. So the only real outlier here is whoever it is within the Trump camp, whether it's the candidate himself or some of his advisors, you know, maybe it's Mr. Manafort. I think Mr. Manafort is pretty much rationally self-interested. I don't see why he would choose to make an issue of his, you know, Russian or post-Soviet connections. I think he wants to win or do as well as he can and get paid. So maybe it's someone else in there. But that's the only outlier, is that the Trump campaign has chosen, in a largely substance-free primary and general election campaign so far, has chosen to make strong substantive stands on these issues related to Russia, and that it absolutely raises questions. Why are they doing it?
Well, why then, if you accept that there's some kind of collusion or common interest here between Putin and Trump, why would Putin be doing this in a way, you know, first of all of these hacking intrusions, if they're done by the FSB or the GRU, the whole point of hacking usually is to go in and out, or even lurk for years if you want to, but not to tip your hand. So why is Putin tipping his hand? Because I recall back when the KGB dissident was murdered with polonium in London, it was as though Putin was getting it both ways. On the one hand, his fingerprints weren't directly on it, but polonium is not something you can get off the shelf. And on the other hand, he was sending a signal to other possible defectors within the intelligence organization of Russia that this is your fate if you squeal. So is there an element of that here, that he's basically is sending the U.S. a signal, and particularly Hillary Clinton a signal, that this is payback for the orange or the colored revolutions and for your meddling in the belief that Putin has, apparently, that Clinton meddled in the 2011 elections in Russia and was behind the demonstrations against Putin?
Yeah, look, I completely agree with the last part of your question here, which is that this is a message to Americans. I don't think it's any more so to Hillary than to Trump. I don't buy that there's a Trump-Putin conspiracy. There might be a bromance on the same level that, you know, Putin and Berlusconi famously partied together, and, you know, Trump clearly has a preoccupation with the idea that, you know, famous, powerful, strong men, you know, respect him because he's one of them. Fine. Okay, this is all on the level of kind of ego games. But on the level of hard policy and politics, I think the Russians are sending a clear message to America, and they are saying, your politics is dirty. You are subject to the same kind of chaos that you have brought to our country and to our region. How does Mr. Putin look at the 2011-2012 so-called white protest movement that broke out on the streets of major Russian cities, you know, which he blamed at the time on Hillary Clinton, but really on the United States? I mean, Hillary was no more involved in things Russia than anyone else senior in the U.S. government. He looks at that as an attempt to bring about violent regime change in Russia. And that is not only a threat, in his view, to his state, it is a threat to him personally, because he is the Tsar, you know, l'état c'est moi. That is the system that he runs in Russia. And so I think the message at the end of the day of all of this is not, you Americans should vote for Donald Trump because he's better than Hillary, or even more silly because he's better for U.S.-Russia relations than Hillary. I mean, what American cares? American in the street, American voter, cares at all about U.S.-Russia relations? Moreover, I would imagine more Americans view Putin as their enemy, and anyone who Putin speaks positively about is not winning points for that. So I don't think Putin is out there trying to get Trump elected so much as he is firing a big broadside across America's bow and saying it is going to get a lot worse if you perpetuate this conflict with us over Ukraine or other parts of the post-Soviet space, continuing military buildup of NATO versus Russia in the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea. You know, we can hit you at home. We can hit you where you're most sensitive. And let me just add this thought, which I think is the most unsettling thing that I have thought of so far. It came up in a conversation with a former senior official. And that is, what if the Russians decide to go after our electronic voting system? Even just injecting a small amount of uncertainty into the electoral outcome in one or two counties or one or two key swing states would literally be devastating for American democracy. And I don't know the exact technical details, but I can't imagine that we are invulnerable to that.
Well, indeed. Yesterday's program, I had Bruce Schneier on, who wrote the op-ed in the Washington Post suggesting that very scenario. And there's no question that since the 2000 meltdown in Florida and the Help America Vote Act, that the various states, there's no uniform voting system, and the various states bought equipment that is incredibly easy to hack, and that there are very few states that have the optical scan, which is the only safe system that has a paper trail. So it's interesting that you should bring that up, Matthew.
Well, this worries me because of the motive question, Ian. We've been talking about, you know, Russia, we've been getting into the weeds and the details of what did Russia do. But the basic question here is Russia's motive. And there, I think the motive is not dissimilar from what we have seen on the part of others who've attacked America at home. And that is taking advantage of our open society to use it against us. We have an open society. We presume people are who they say they are. We're very generous, very accessible. And all of those things are things that cause us to think that, you know, our system is right and we should go promoting it around the world. And the sort of beautiful, poetic irony of that is exactly what our adversaries will seek to use against us now that they have the capabilities. And this is a case of that. And the details, frankly, of just, you know, how much does Putin like or dislike Trump is really beside the point. Our institutions are under attack, and that's very scary.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Matthew Rudzinski.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rudzinski, who's the director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the courts have rejected Republican efforts at voter suppression. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And he has an article in The Guardian, Voting Rights Rulings Could Deal Blow to Republicans in 2016 Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And this flurry of rulings against the Republicans and against Republican governors in extremely key swing states is pretty surprising, is it not? Just in the last couple of weeks, the courts have struck down voting ID restrictions, etc., in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, and in Kansas, and in Texas. And some of the rulings and opinions by these judges have been pretty nasty and really basically saying this has nothing to do with protecting voting. This is pure discrimination.
That's right. Well, I think the timing is probably more surprising than the actual trend of where the courts are going. I think there's sort of two time frames to talk about here. One is the time frame of these voter ID laws that started to be introduced in 2005 or thereabouts, starting with Georgia and then Indiana. And in the first go around, the federal courts were relatively indulgent. The Indiana law was upheld by the Supreme Court. And Justice Stevens, who was one of the people who was indulgent of the law at the time, appears to have undergone a change of heart. Judge Posner of the Court of Appeals in the Midwest had a change of heart about the Indiana case. And then subsequently in a Wisconsin case, he was rather dismissive of the case against voter ID in 2007. And he was absolutely scathing about voter ID laws a few years later. So we've seen that the courts have understood belatedly that this is not what it appears to be. It's not a common sense measure against fraud, as the Republicans like to call it. It is a nakedly partisan push for advantage in elections, unfair advantage in elections. And specifically in parts of the country which either have a history of this or the right demographics, it's also very much something targeted at minority groups that enjoy protection under the Voting Rights Act. So the second time frame to look at is the decision also by the Supreme Court in 2013 to gut one of the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the one that gave the Justice Department the authority to approve or withhold approval of voting arrangements in states and parts of other states that are covered by that part of the law. So the law we're talking about in Texas that's just been ruled against, the law in North Carolina that's just been ruled against, could not have existed before the Shelby versus Holder decision in 2013. And in fact, the North Carolina law was pushed through very, very fast right after that decision came down. So again, we're seeing, you know, waves of judicial opinion. And, you know, just to avoid too much confusion on the Voting Rights Act question, with the inability of the Justice Department to make a preemptive decision on the legality of these laws, states or individuals or entities can still sue under the Voting Rights Act under a different section, Section 2, to allege racial discrimination. And that's why you're seeing some of this very strong wording, especially out of North Carolina, where the justices of the Fourth Circuit described an almost surgical precision on the part of the Republican legislature there to disenfranchise minority voters.
But the Section 5 that was struck down by the Roberts Court, the justification was, from Roberts in the majority opinion, was that, well, these are different times, we don't need them anymore. Well,
so that's right. I mean, you know, this is something that was abundantly clear to those with eyes to see at the time. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissent, the blistering dissent against the Roberts Court decision on Shelby versus Holder, said this is like throwing your umbrella away in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And that's in fact what we've seen, that the removal of that protection has led to a flurry of laws. I mentioned Texas and North Carolina, but you're also seeing it in lots of small ways. There's a great piece in the New York Times this morning talking about harassment, other methods being used in Georgia and across the South, where there's no longer, you know, the policeman on the beat, and people are doing all kinds of things, big and small, to try and wrest partisan advantage. And specifically in the South, you very often have, you know, a racial divide along partisan lines, that the white population tends to vote Republican and the black population tends to vote Democrat. So it has a very, very distinct racial flavor to it. And of course, you know, the history of Jim Crow. John Roberts may think that it's done and dusted, but, you know, it's still there and is being revived actively in many quarters of the country.
So you mentioned that in spite of these rulings in these important swing states of North Carolina, Texas is a pretty key state, but it's not likely to swing back in the Democrats' directions. Certainly, Wisconsin is. Kansas, of course, is what's the matter with Kansas? That's lost forever, I think, to the Democrats. But as you mentioned, the New York Times is carrying a story on in Monday's edition. It made me almost think that which side won the Civil War. It's extraordinary to think
about. Right. I mean, we've seen similar things in previous election cycles. The stories in the New York Times about Sparta, Georgia, where individual voters were being summoned by the police to court hearings to defend their eligibility to vote, was reminiscent to me of something that happened in 2004 in Orlando, which at the time was, you know, deemed to be the swing state, Orlando, Florida, where members of the state police in Florida were knocking on the doors of little old ladies and accusing them of possibly being involved in a felonious conspiracy, purely on the basis that another grizzled old gentleman was going around and offering to collect their absentee ballots and delivering them to a polling station on their behalf. This is something that had a deeply chilling effect on minority voting in Orlando in 2004, and you know, similar tactics were tried with other groups as well. So this is something that, you know, is very much in the playbook of how elections get contested in certain states. And, you know, you take away the protection of the Justice Department, and this is the consequence. And it was a foreseeable consequence, I would argue, and Justice Roberts chose not to foresee it because he has an ideological desire going back 30 years or more to water down the Voting Rights Act and push it back.
So in terms of the celebrations, if you will, that are going on, or at least the sighs of relief in these states, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Texas, where these very restrictive voter ID laws have been overturned by the courts, that doesn't mean that suddenly the Democrats have an open field. I mean, there's still an awful lot of these restrictive laws in place, aren't they, even in some of these very same states?
Right. Well, we should make clear that, you know, there are two or three things to distinguish here. One is, you know, there's been some work. It's relatively incomplete because the sample sizes aren't that big. But there has been some work done to try and assess what damage is done by voter ID laws in terms of voter turnout, in terms of voter participation, the ability of people to register, and so on and so forth. The Government Accountability Office did one of these studies and showed in, I believe, Kansas and Tennessee, I may be getting it wrong, but two states in that part of the country, that they estimated there was somewhere between 2-3% drop off in participation by anticipated Democratic voters. The Republicans themselves, Dick Armey, the former House leader from Texas, a former political director of the Republican Party in Texas, also have talked about a 3% figure. You know, that they were clearly aiming to shave 3% off the Democratic vote in any given election. So, you know, whether the figure is 2%, 4%, you know, it's certainly a significant number, especially in a close race. And it's all directed in one direction. You know, one of the things that the North Carolina ruling pointed out is, you know, there was work done by the North Carolina legislature to look at, you know, where are all these extra votes coming from that enabled Obama, for example, to win the state in 2008. And the answer is, you know, here's the impact of early voting, here's the impact of Sunday voting, when a lot of black churches arrange transport for people to go to the polls. And they saw specifically, you know, where are the people who vote Democrat, you know, which is a coded way of saying African Americans, you know, where are they having the biggest impact and how can we push back against that? And the answer is early voting, it's same day registration, and then voter ID gives them an additional tool to make it difficult for people without government ID who tend to be poorer, more transient, and, you know, often either students or people of color. You know, this is a very specifically aimed weapon, you know, an almost surgically precise weapon, as the court ruled. So there is a culture there of wanting to wage partisan warfare in a very nasty way. And one thing that I've been hearing from voting rights groups is that they intend to remain very vigilant, even in states where most of the more progressive voting rules have been reinstated, like in North Carolina. You know, they think it's entirely possible that voters will be challenged in one way or another, that misinformation can be put out. That's a time-honored technique that you send out flyers in certain neighborhoods saying, you know, election day is now on Wednesday, or your polling place has been changed, you know, that kind of tactic. There are a number of lesser things that can happen to depress turnout in specific groups of the population, and it's not unreasonable to expect that people will try that.
Well, just in closing then, it would seem to me that when you talk about the percentages that shaves off by restricting the vote, suppressing the vote, making it difficult. Elections are often very close on the presidential side. Obama did win pretty handily, but most of the elections in the modern era have been very tight. And, you know, Kennedy was within 100,000. Bush, for God's sake, George W. Bush won by 537 votes. So every vote does count. What's your sense of this election in terms of the tightness? Because, you know, not only are these some, there's still some voting restrictions in play. The Green Party is probably going to take about 3% of the votes away from Democrats. And the Libertarians probably going to win about 6-7%, half of which would be Democrat, half of which would normally be Republican. So that's, you know, there's six. Clinton's already got a minus six going in by that logic. So do you expect this to be a very tight race?
Well, it's worth remembering that, of course, the presidential election is, in fact, 51 elections. It's not one election.
Sure.
It goes state by state. And, you know, what really matters is how close is the race in those crucial swing states that are going to decide it. You know, it's really hard at this stage to prognosticate how that's going to go. But it's certainly not unreasonable, as you point out, to assume that at least some of these states are going to be very tightly contested. You know, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin may be in play, although if Wisconsin's in play, it's probably pretty bad news for Clinton. You know, it's very hard to know. You know, I think the question at this point is, do we have confidence that the electoral systems in the states where it could get close are well enough run that we can have confidence in the outcome? And voter ID and these other repressive laws obviously play into that question, but so do other things. You know, the reliability of the voting machines, the number of polling stations available, especially in poorer neighborhoods, do people have to suffer extraordinarily long lines, as we've seen in a number of recent elections? You know, unfortunately, I think the answer to the question of do we have confidence in those electoral systems is still very much no. And that's the abiding concern. You know, this is another variation on a long-standing theme, which is there's no commitment in this country to having transparency and efficiency of well-run elections. I live in California, where things, relatively speaking, are much better than the average. But there are problems here, too. This is not something that can be fixed quickly. This is a country that loves to have lots of races on, you know, on any given election day. You have issues of different languages, different groups, and if you add to that, you know, bureaucratic incompetence and or corruption and political interference, it gets very difficult to run a decent system, especially when the management is devolved to the state level and often to the county level or even the city level. So, you know, we have a country where things do not work especially well, and if we have a close election and there's no real way of telling at this point, things could get very nasty. And we've already seen the rhetoric coming from the Trump campaign is already anticipating playing dirty with any possible question about the outcome. Trump on Monday said he's expecting the election to be rigged. So already the rhetoric coming out is just, you know, get ready for a fight. Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Andrew Gumbel.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who's worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. His latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And he has an article at The Guardian, Voting Rights Ruling Could Deal Blow to Republicans in 2016 Elections. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.